Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
AT&T connects an ode to podcasts. Connect the alarm. Change the podcast you stream. Connect the snooze. 10 more minutes to dream. Connect the shower. Lather up with the news. Sports talk, comedians, or movie reviews. Connect with that 3-hour philosophy show. Change the drive into work in traffic so slow. Connect the dishes to voices that glow. Thank you to the geniuses of spoken audio. Connect the stories. Change your perspective. Connecting changes everything. AT&T.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio. Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeartRadio, and I love all things tech. And today, we're going to listen to another Tech Stuff classic episode. This episode originally published on June 5th, 2013, and it has the title, It's a Bird, It's a Plane, It's a Superconductor. Yep, we're going to talk about superconductors, those super cool, literally, pieces of technology that allow us to do all sorts of really advanced stuff. I hope you guys enjoy. Let's listen in. So here's a fundamental problem with electronics, with any sort of circuitry, with any kind of system, really. It's not just electronics. That's one way we can look at it. But there's this problem where you pour energy into a system, and because of things like entropy, the output you get is less than the energy you put in. Now, of course, we know we cannot create or destroy energy, correct?
Right.
Yeah, it's one of those laws of thermodynamics. And if you try and break them, then the thermodynamics police show up. So actually, it just means that you cannot break that law. So if you can't break that law, if you pour energy into a system and you're not getting as much output as you're getting input, it's because you're losing energy through some other action. Normally, in almost every system that we're really familiar with, that's heat, right? Heat
right.
becomes a byproduct. Energy goes to produce heat, which means that whatever you were trying to do is slightly less effective than what you had intended. So we see this with things like car engines are a great example. You pour in fuel, the engine burns up the fuel and converts that into power, but you don't get as much power out as you're getting energy in from the source of that fuel. So same sort of thing is true with electronics. And in this case, the thing we talk about when we're talking about losing energy is called resistance.
Right.
That's the resistance of any particular material to the flow of electricity through that material. So with that basic information there, now we're going to really dive into the very, very basic building blocks of electronics.
Yes, because the thing is that superconductors lose no energy to resistance.
Right, they have no resistance.
Exactly. However, they require extraordinarily cold temperatures, like on the magnitude of 39 kelvins, which is cold.
That's cold, yeah. When you remember,
it's not warm.
Zero Kelvin is zero molecular movement. That's absolute zero. That's like if you were to go into the deepest reaches of space and there are no molecules moving around, everything is perfectly still, that's zero Kelvin.
Right. 39 is equivalent to negative 234 degrees Celsius or negative 389 degrees Fahrenheit.
Right. So that's pretty cold. But to understand, again,
right,
about resistance, let's take this tour through the building blocks of electronics. So now, the early understanding we had about electricity gave us some ideas that we kind of have to work around these days, like specifically the idea of current. Current is a confusing thing for someone who doesn't understand electricity, because the direction of current runs counter to the actual flow of electrons.
Oh, right. When all of these terms were being created, we didn't know as much about subatomic particles, aka much at all,
right,
anything, we do today. So
before we understood anything about electricity, we began to learn things about charge and the idea of opposite charges attracting one another and like charges repelling one another. Now, we could have called electrons positive charge. We could have done that. There's no reason why we would have said electrons are negatively charged. It's just a word.
Sure.
Right? But that was what was considered a negative charge. And then you would have the opposite would obviously be a positive charge. You know, we could have called these left and right or up and down or anything, really. But
banana and oboe would be my choices.
Everyone knows the oboe is nature's opposite to the banana. So these opposite charges, the negative and the positive, attract one another. Now, if you were to have a negatively charged material and a positively charged material, within the same general area of each other, the potential that separated those opposite electric charges would be called voltage. All right. So that's when someone's talking about voltage, they're talking about this potential that's separating the opposite electric charges. And it's the capacity that they would have for doing work if those opposite charges were connected together somehow. So you would have to have something that would allow these charges to mix together. So back in the early days of electricity, before we really understood the mechanics of it, you would think that, all right, well, all the positively charged particles would leap over to the negative side, and the negative charged particles would leap to the positive side until the charges had equalized. Right. And even if you had one material that was more negatively charged than the other material was positively charged, the actual negative charge would also even out throughout
eventually,
the
like
entire
osmosis,
material.
It would kind of work itself out. Yeah.
So you would end up with a larger amount of material that had a negative charge. It would just be a lower negative charge than the original material you started with, right? So here we were still thinking about this as these little charged bodies, these charged particles, both of positive and negative, zipping across. And you can measure voltage by measuring the two different points. So, for example, if you have one on the positive node and one on the electric node, or negative node rather, you then look at those two contact points. That's where you get your voltage. If you're using the same point of contact and you're checking different other electrodes, that same contact, the contact you're using for all of them, we usually call the ground.
All okay, right? Sure.
So that's the ground contact. Now, a material that does conduct electricity is called a conductor for that very reason, right?
So, convenient,
and
yes.
There are some materials that are very good conductors. A lot of the metals, for example, are great conductors.
How conductive a material is depends on how easily its component atoms donate electrons.
Right, right. You need to have these free electrons. Free electrons are when you have an atom, obviously you have an electron shell or several shells, depending on how large the
composition.
Atom is.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And And if you have free electrons that aren't tied down to anything on the outer shells, then that allows electricity to pass more freely. Because what happens is a new electron comes in, this is oversimplifying, but a new electron comes in and essentially bonks out one of the other electrons in that outer shell, which then will bonk out one further down the line. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a lot of free electrons, then that allows this passage to happen fairly easily. And that's what allows you to connect these differently charged materials to equal that out. We call this a current, but again, the current is the idea of positively charged particles passing from one material to the other. As we learned later, it's actually electrons that are passing through, not positive charges. But we stuck with the
terminology, which means
that when you say current, you're actually talking about the opposite direction as what the electrons are really going through. So if you're talking about a circuit's current, you are looking at it going positive to negative, when in reality the electrons are going negative to positive.
Basically proving that Benjamin Franklin was not a time traveler.
Right, right. Yeah, there are a lot of jokes on the internet saying that we have Benjamin Franklin to blame for this misunderstanding. That, again, is oversimplifying it. Franklin was one of, but not the only leading thinker.
He was a spokesperson, kind of, at a certain point.
Yeah. He was like the mascot for electricity before we knew what we could do with it.
Yeah.
Now, current we measure in amperes or amps, and an ampere is the rate of flow of 1 coulomb of charge in 1 second past some given point. And so that raises the question, what is a coulomb?
It's a whole bunch of charge.
Yeah, it's a lot of charge. It's actually quite a bit of charge, but you know, we won't bog down.
It's not technically important.
No, not for this discussion. But just know that it's a lot of charge. So if you hear someone talking about a coulomb, that's a lot of charge. Now, current, of course, does have the direction as the flow of positive charges. You can think of positive charge in a way as vacancies, holes, positive holes that could accept an electron, right? Because if you have a buildup of negative particles, if there's no positively charged part, if there are no vacancies at another point, then that charge is just going to keep building up. The electrons have nowhere to carry it anywhere.
Yeah.
Right. So that brings us to the concept of an insulator. Now, an insulator is sort of the opposite of a conductor. This is a material that charge cannot flow through.
Those component atoms, their electrons just want to stay put.
Yeah, yeah. Usually you don't have any free electrons on the outside. They're all bonded together. So that means that an incoming electron has nowhere to go. So with nowhere to go, then this stuff just halts the flow of electricity. And this includes things like air is an insulator. Now, granted, if you were to pour enough energy into air, you could ionize it and then it becomes a conductor. But you have to pour energy into air for that to happen. That's what happens with lightning strikes, that kind of thing.
Sure.
Otherwise, it's a...
Yeah, more
it's
commonly, it's all those things, you know, like rubber or glass or...
Right. Exactly, exactly. Now, we've covered conductors. We've covered insulators. That brings us to semiconductors. Now, this is a term that a lot of people are familiar with because semiconductors, we talk about that all the time. We talk about electronics, like microprocessors, semiconductor plants, or a silicon wafer. That's what a silicon chip that has a microprocessor on it. So what exactly is a semiconductor? Well, if you're looking at the name, it kind of gives it away. It's a material that can act like a conductor or it can act like an insulator. Now, naturally, if you were to make a wafer of silicon, it was pure silicon, it would be an insulator because those electrons are all tied up, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you can't push more electrons through it. However, if you were to start introducing impurities into the silicon on purpose, this isn't...
Right. Yeah, like phosphorus or boron are two typical ones.
Exactly. Then you are doing a process that's called doping. And in the semiconductor business, that's not a bad thing. You won't get thrown out of the Hall of Fame of semiconductors for doping. In fact, doping is necessary to make a semiconductor work. Now, if you were to dope a semiconductor with atoms that have extra electrons, extra being free electrons in that outer shell. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that they're actually carrying around
more electrons.
Suitcases full of electrons, right? Yeah, like phosphorus. Phosphorus
exactly.
has some free electrons.
Phosphorus has a free electrons. Then you would get what is called n-type semiconductor material because it has more negatively charged particles.
Negatively
available.
N-type, yes.
N-type, yep. Mm-hmm. Now boron has what we would call vacancies or holes that electrons could flow into. So if you put boron, if you introduce boron into silicon, it would have availability to accept electrons.
A positively charged or P-type.
Exactly. And if you were to take both of these types of doping and apply them to one silicon wafer, so that let's just say on the left side you have N-type silicon, and on the right side you have P-type silicon, that would allow electrons to flow across in the direction from negative to positive, correct?
Correct.
And it would prevent the flow of electrons to go from positive to negative because, again, those negative electrons in the N-type silicon will repel any incoming electrons. This is the basis of a very specific type of electronic component called the diode. Diodes are important. They're kind of a one-way street in electronics. And one of the reasons this is important is when you have something like alternating current. Alternating current, it's exactly what it sounds like. It alternates direction. Remember, I was saying before, current is the flow of positive charge. In a circuit, if you have alternating current running through it, then that current is running one way and then the other way, and it alternates at thousands of times per second. We call it hertz, those cycles per second. So it's usually like 20,000 hertz. So 20,000 times a second, it's going poo back and forth. Now
I like that sound effect.
Poo. Yeah, that's the sound of electrons just zigzagging.
Doing their thing.
But a lot of our electronics don't run on alternating current. They need to run on direct current. So diodes are a good way of addressing that because they will only allow charge to pass through in one direction. So even if you have an alternating current, then it's going to prevent current from passing through one way and allow it to pass through the other way. That's one of the ways we use to transform alternating current into direct current. So
right, and this problem is why you get those little boxes on your electric plugs to transform the alternating current coming in through your system, through the power lines.
Through that the pluggy thing. Outlets. It's been a long day.
It has. I'm giggling
day.
More than usual. Sorry,
also,
people who hate me giggling.
We've been in a meeting for a long, long time. If you need to know how long, just a quick aside, check out Josh and Chuck's series, Trapped in a Meeting. It's very good, it's very funny, and it's very real.
It's so real. It's my video debut, so check that out.
That's right. You can see Lauren blocking me for almost every episode. I can just see like either the front of my face or the back of my head in almost every shot. But that's just me complaining. That's fine. So let's move on to we mentioned resistance. Resistance is this property that resists the flow of a charge. And it depends on the material of the conductor and the flaws that conductor might have that create resistance. The gauge of the conductor, so example, the gauge of wire.
Mm-hmm.
So
how much of it there is.
Right. The thinner the wire, the greater the resistance in general. So if you're talking about copper wire and you're talking about smaller gauges, which are actually larger wires, I don't know why that is. I'm sure someone out there understands why. The gauge and size are inversely related.
I'm sure it's one of those aperture related things.
There's
you know,
something out there,
those,
I'm sure. And I bet I could have found it out easily if I had looked it up. I didn't think to. But I'm sure some of our electrician friends out there know exactly why. Anyway, the larger the diameter of the wire, the lower the resistance. And the other thing is the temperature of the material itself. In fact, if you lower the temperature of the material, then you can decrease the resistance, and that's the very basis of
superconductors. Right.
So,
right. And that temperature comes in because heat makes atoms bang around into each other more,
right.
which is part of what causes resistance. And on the flip side, resistance causes heat.
Right. Those atoms are starting to bang around. That actually creates heat. It's essentially friction on an atomic level
mm-hmm.
or subatomic level because you're talking about electrons. But it still creates heat, and that's where you get this loss of energy in your system or loss of output. You're not really losing energy in the sense that you know, it's still going somewhere. It's just no longer contained within the system that you have created.
Right. So what does Ohm's law have to do with this?
Right. Ohm's law is the relationship between voltage and resistance. All right. So it is explained as voltage equals current times resistance, or because we can switch these around, current equals voltage divided by resistance. So you look at the voltage across whatever the resistor itself is, whether it's a specific component in an electronic circuit or the overall circuit or just a wire. And that way you can, if you know the voltage and the current, you can determine what the resistance is. Actually, as long as you know any of those two, you can determine the third because you know what how they relate to one another. Now, on top of all of this, we then have the concept of power. This is that output that you're getting. And power is, we measure that in watts, W-A-T-T-S. And power released into a resistor equals the voltage times the current, or voltage squared divided by resistance, or current squared multiplied by resistance. The point we're getting to is that these basic concepts of electronics are all very, very closely related to one another. And the more we understand about them, the greater potential we have to creating new stuff that really takes advantage of.
Oh, right. It was our eventual understanding of these basic principles that has allowed us to kind of break the physics or twinge the physics
to
make them go.
What happened was, we understood things how things worked in kind of our normal
under normal
experience.
Room temperature kind situations.
Because you know early people working in electronics early electronics work
Neanderthals
you know when they were trying to plug in their Xbox the people who were working on electricity very early on when we were just learning about the principles of electricity and what it is, how these different elements relate to one another, they didn't necessarily have the capacity to alter things enough to really see, like, gosh, what would happen if we
super cooled.
Yeah, they didn't have the ability to do it early on, but it wasn't too late when they started to really experiment with it. But we'll get into that. All right, so that is our down and dirty basic electronics coverage there. And now we can actually look at superconductors and explain exactly what they are, how they work, and why they're so amazing.
We're going to take a quick break from this classic episode about superconductors to thank our sponsors.
All right, back to superconductors. So we've covered conductors, insulators, we've covered semiconductors, we've heard about resistance. What exactly is a superconductor? All right, technically this is some sort of material that will conduct electricity without resistance below a certain temperature. And you don't want that resistance, obviously, because, again, you have that loss of energy. You want it to be as efficient as possible. So if you could find a material that does not convert any of that energy into heat and it's all output, then you've just dramatically increased the efficiency of your system.
Mm-hmm.
It's about as close to perpetual motion as we can ever expect to get.
Which is really exciting, for cost purposes and all kinds of fun research bits, which we'll get into in a minute.
Sure. And in fact, according to superconductors.org, which has a lot of really fun information about superconductors, by the way, scientists call it a, quote, macroscopic quantum phenomenon, end quote, which is huge, literally, because you're talking about macroscopic.
Uh-huh.
But that's the thing, is that quantum phenomena, we normally think of quantum mechanics, quantum phenomena, as happening on a subatomic scale,
mm-hmm.
right? So small that even our most powerful light microscope couldn't see it. You'd have to use something like an electron tunneling microscope.
It's highly theoretical and all very tricky. It's really interesting because our laws of physics, as we know it, start breaking down at that point. But
right.
but it's really hard to figure out what's going on there because it's so darn tiny.
Right. Yeah. It's a totally different set of rules than what we're used to on the classic level. And to have something on the macroscopic level that seems to behave under these quantum phenomena is pretty amazing. So exactly what's going on? Well, let's go back a little bit and look at the history of learning about this, right? So way back in 1911, a Dutch physicist whose name I am now going to butcher, and I apologize to anyone out there who is from the Netherlands who's going to wince at everything I say, Heike Kamerlingh Onnes of Leiden University. And I bet it's Leiden University, too. As soon as I said it, it's Leiden, because Leiden jars. But anyway, this physicist discovered superconductivity, or at least observed it for the first time, as far as we know, looking at solid mercury. He had made a solid mercury wire and cooled it to the temperature of about 4 Kelvin using liquid helium. And that is about negative 452 degrees Fahrenheit or negative 269 degrees Celsius.
And he noticed that when he did this, its resistance suddenly disappeared.
Right. So this was interesting. You know, this is the sort of thing that I always imagine scientists doing. You know, like sitting around a lab and just saying, huh, I got this stuff. I wonder what happens if I do X to it, you know? Let's drop the temperature down to almost absolute zero and see if that does anything interesting. I know it's way more complicated than that, but I like to think that that's what scientists are doing.
Yeah, and what was really going on there was that the mercury at that temperature underwent a phase transition.
Right.
But we'll get more into that in a second.
Right. So then we skip ahead a little bit. That was 1911. In 1933, some German researchers, Walter Meissner, not the famed theater mentor, because I have a lot of Meissner technique.
Different guy, sure.
Different guy, Meissner. And Robert Oschenfeld discovered that a superconducting material will repel a magnetic field. Now, this is super cool as well.
Oh, dear.
I keep using that. I didn't mean to, and I should have caught myself. But it's okay. Really interesting. It's really interesting. If you've ever seen, there's lots of videos on YouTube, right, of people using magnets and supercooled superconductor material, and they can lock the material in a levitating state above the magnet, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes they have a superconducting base that is supercooled, and then they put a magnet on top of it, and it seems to just hang in the air. Now, technically, if you actually listen to the physicists who talk about this, there's a great TED Talk where a guy demonstrates this.
Mm-hmm. In 2011, we'll link it on social. I mean, everyone's seen it, I'm sure.
Yeah, but yeah. We'll link it anyway, because it's still fun to watch.
Mm-hmm.
He explains that technically it's not levitation. It's what they call quantum lock. And so it's a little different from that, but we'll get more into that in a little bit. And then you skip ahead to 1957, when a trio of scientists, Leon N. Cooper, John Bardeen, and John Robert Schrieffer, proposed the first successful model that explained superconductivity. This might be a good time to mention that while we talk about models that explain superconductivity, honestly, scientists are still learning about the properties of superconductors and how they do what they do and why they operate at certain temperatures better than other temperatures. So while we're describing this stuff and while we have superconductors in actual use around the world in thousands of different applications, we still don't understand everything about
precisely
it.
How it's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when I say we, I'm not talking about just me and Lauren. I'm talking about super smart people. That's their job. We're still learning. This is one of those things I always find exciting. It's just, you know, when you know that you don't know everything, that always gives you that kind of tingle to, like, you want to learn more. So their theory became known as the BCS theory, and it earned them the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1972. Now, we kind of need to sort of talk about what this theory says.
Okay, the atoms in a conductive material that have given up electrons are then positively charged ions, right?
Right.
Okay. And when electrons are flowing through them, they're attracted to those negatively charged electrons. Cool.
You're right.
Cool. That's a really bad word to use in the middle of this podcast.
I know.
Okay.
Already happened to me 3 or 4 times.
Under usual circumstances, those ions kind of crunching together towards the electrons that are flowing through them would cause resistance, mm-hmm. but not in superconductors. And what we kind of didn't realize until we started getting into quantum mechanics is that that resistance happens because electrons have properties of both particles and waves.
Right. This is that duality thing that always got me confused when I got to that point in learning about science, was the idea that something can behave as both a wave and a particle. We see this a lot in quantum mechanics, and it's part of the reason why it's such an interesting and counterintuitive field.
Absolutely, yeah. It's, I mean, honestly, my brain kind of just goes, well, okay, that's fine.
To be fair, I think a lot of string theorists have that same reaction to their work. I mean, I'm being honest. I've seen interviews where they say, there comes a point where you just have to say, this is how it works, because it's how it works.
It always feels a little bit like doublethink to me. But yeah, so we've got electrons acting like particles and waves, and those excited ions that are in the conductive material kind of create counter ripples in this flowing lake or river of electrons.
Okay.
And that winds up causing that resistance.
I see.
But in superconductors, the electrons assume a nearly identical speed and direction, forming a kind of single organized wave that resists that disruption from the ions.
I see. So instead of having, let's put this on a macro scale, and keep in mind that whenever you change anything from the quantum scale to the macro scale and you're using an analogy, it's imperfect to say the
Right, and this is also an extreme oversimplification that I am presenting to you, so.
But let's imagine that you have a room full of people and you have one doorway leading out of the room, and someone walks into the room and says, free cake, and then leaves, and then everyone just tries to rush the door. All right, well, the fact that people could only fit through the door a few at a time, but everyone's trying to get through there, that kind of represents resistance, in a way. Now let's say that someone comes in and says, free cake, but there's plenty for everyone, so just come in the same order that you walked into the room, and everyone obeys the rules, and they all just smoothly exit. That's kind of the idea of superconductors. You've created this experience where everything's happening in a very controlled way.
Right, yeah. It's sort of like if all those people were members of a dance troupe, and they just kind of fell into line and danced quietly out.
In fact, that is an analogy I've seen several times when looking at superconductors. Now, the BCS theory that we had mentioned explains that the electrons travel in ever-changing Cooper pairs, named after Leon N. Cooper, one of the three of that
BCS
team,
theory,
right? And that so you have that leading electron. The pairs have a leading electron and a following electron. They're both going down this pathway. Keeping in mind, electrons do repel one another.
Which is where the ever-changing comes in. They kind of swap around a whole bunch.
Right. So you've got this pair going down, swapping places occasionally, and the positively charged ions start to be attracted to that leading electron, which means that you have a growing positive charge, which starts pulling that second electron even harder. That creates this increased pressure, if you will, of pull, really. Right, it's pulling those electrons even harder than it normally would because the positive charge is growing. And all of these different opposing forces essentially end up canceling each other out so that you don't end up with resistance.
Right, and this is opposite to the way that resistance normally works, which is so cool.
Right, right.
Not cool, so interesting.
Now, keep in mind, this was the first working model of superconductivity. And then future study would end up kind of tweaking this and changing our understanding a little bit. In fact, in 1962, we then had Brian D. Josephson, who predicted that electrical current would flow between two superconducting materials, even if they were separated by non-superconductors or even insulators. Now, that prediction that he made was later on confirmed, and he earned the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1973. So 1 year after the BCS team won the Nobel Prize in Physics. So clearly superconductors, big important thing in physics from the 50s through the 70s and up through to today.
Oh, sure. More research conducted in the 80s would change the field all over again, but we will talk more about that in a moment.
Yeah. We have to then discuss the different major types of superconductors. And they're different ways you can divide them up, but the most common way is to refer to them as type 1 and type 2, which not that helpful upon the surface, so let's actually define these. Type 1 superconductors, made out of pure metal, right? So you get this pure metal material, whatever the metal is, and then you have to cool it to a point where the metal exhibits zero electrical resistivity and perfect diamagnetism. So we're talking now about any particular metal. It doesn't matter which one it is. The temperature will vary depending upon the actual metal you're using.
Right.
Right? So lead is different from copper, that kind of thing. But they all have this.
They all have this specific critical temperature.
Right. And most of them are pretty cold. So you have to use something really, really cold to cool them, like liquid helium.
Right.
Which is hard to get. It's
very
rare.
Expensive.
It's expensive, yes. Mm-hmm. And there's not that much left of it. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, we don't have enough helium for all the stuff we would like to do with helium. For one thing, there are all those children's parties. And you think I'm joking. But I'm not. Helium is actually being used in those helium balloons that you see, that you can go out and buy. There are scientists who say it's a real shame that we're using helium to entertain children when we could be using it to
run MRI machines
or a super collider or one of a thousand other devices. So that's one of the downsides of the type 1 superconductors is that they do need to be cooled to these very, very low temperatures. And if they go above that temperature, the superconductivity is broken. You can get it back by cooling it back down again.
Right.
But the actual properties it exhibits as a superconductor go away if the temperature goes over whatever its critical temperature is for being a superconductor.
Another thing that will cause the breakdown of the superconductive state is if you subject it to what's called a critical magnetic field.
Right. So remember, we talked about diamagnetism. This means that magnetic fields cannot penetrate this superconductor metal while it's in the superconductor state. So you can't make it's what allows a superconductor to kind of float above a magnet, although with type 1 superconductors, that always tends to be wobbly. If you've ever seen a demonstration of this, whatever the material
is
floating.
A little bit is going to be kind of spinning and shaking.
It doesn't hold a position very well. It does tend to wobble quite a bit. But if you were to introduce a magnetic field that is stronger than what that superconductor can withstand,
deflect.
Expelling magnetic
correct,
fields.
Correct, thank you.
But if it's too strong a magnetic field, it again will break down that superconducting state and it will just become a regular conductor as opposed to a superconductor. So you have to maintain its critical temperature and make sure it is not subjected to a magnetic field above that critical limit. All right, so that's type 1 superconductors, which then raises the question, what is a type 2 superconductor? Now, these are made up of alloys, and they have a much more complex diamagnetic feature to them, right? They're not as simple as type 1. They actually have two thresholds for critical magnetic fields. All right, so if the magnetic field is below the primary threshold, the type 2 superconductor acts more or less like a type 1. So in other words, if you supercool this down to below that threshold, it'll behave just like it would be, just as if it were a type 1 superconductor. Now, if that magnetic field goes above that threshold, but still is below the second threshold, you then have a superconductor entering into what is called a vortex state. Which to me just sounds like it's some sort of science fiction-y, like pulled through the portal into another dimension. But that's not exactly what's happening.
It's pretty science fiction-y. What's going on here is that currents or whirlpools of superconducting material will flow around spots of normal material.
Yeah, so you have these islands of conducting material and these vortices of superconducting material. So within the same substance, some of it is acting like a superconductor. Some of it's acting like a conductor.
And this creates really interesting properties that we'll cover in a sec here.
Right. So that's what really makes it different. Now, granted, if you were to, again, increase that magnetic field so that it goes above that second threshold, the superconductivity properties break down again.
Mm-hmm.
So and you do have to cool down the type 2 superconductors, although there's been some amazing work fairly recently.
And that 80s stuff that I was talking about.
Right, yeah. that we'll cover in a minute that really kind of give us some hope for future applications.
We'll be right back with more on superconductors in just a moment, but first let's take another quick break.
All right, so we talked a little bit earlier about this levitating effect that you can see with superconductors. It's not really levitating. It's called quantum lock or flux pinning.
Oh, right. And this has to do with that vortex state that we mentioned a second ago.
Right. This is for type 2 specifically. Type 1 superconductors can do this too. But as we said, they're very unsteady. But type 2, if you keep it within that critical boundary between those two thresholds we talked about, where it's above the type 1 threshold but below the type 2 threshold, you can have this quantum lock where you can put a magnet above a superconducting base or a super cooled superconductor over a magnet and lock it into a position where it's seemingly just floating. Really, it is floating above the magnet or the magnets floating above the superconductor, however you've had it arranged.
And that TED talk that we mentioned from 2011 that probably you've seen that was calling it quantum levitation. You know, it's the dude just pushed a magnet around and it kind of flowed in a circle.
Yeah.
And it was
he had a big circular magnet.
It was exactly.
It looked like a donut in the sense that it had a band of magnetic material that runs in a circle. But it was just a band. It wasn't a disc or anything. It was a band of this magnetic material. So yeah, like a donut. And then had this super cooled superconducting material that he put it in place above the band. So it's not touching the band at all. It's floating above it. And he could actually change the orientation of the superconductor. So it could be flat or he could tilt it. So suddenly it was at a 45 degree tilt. And then he could just give it a little push and it would float around the circle of this magnetic band.
Just floating as though it were on a track. But not touching anything.
Right. So there's no real, apart from air resistance, there's no real force acting against it. So in other words, it's about as close to perpetual motion as you can get. It would just keep going around and around and around until the air resistance finally would make it stop. And he even demonstrates that it is completely independent of gravity as well. If you were to turn the whole thing upside down,
which he did.
It is pretty awesome. It then floats underneath the band. But again, you can change the orientation of the superconducting material.
Right.
And it's kind of a mind-blowing video.
It's really terrific. And what's going on in it is that so as superconductors cool down, they increasingly expel magnetic fields.
Right.
And when you get a type 2 superconductor into that vortex state, electrons can form these kind of eddy currents that produce a counter field.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of crazy. And so you've got this expelling of fields out from the superconducting material. You also have the quote unquote normal islands of material in there that are attracted to whatever the magnet is. And so it's the balance of those two that make that type 2 superconductor stable as opposed to the type 1s that are all wobbly.
Mm-hmm. There's also been, you might remember, back around the year 2000, some people got a whole lot of attention for levitating a frog and, you know, water and hazelnuts and kinds of fun stuff. It was along the same principles and works because although technically, you know, we think of things like water and organic tissue, like frogs, as being non-magnetic, they will exhibit a very weak repulsive effect when placed in a very strong magnetic field.
I know that I can be repulsed by frogs quite easily. However, if you want to have a fun experiment with frogs and magnetism, you take a frog and you go up to your little sister and you rub it against her hair and then you run. It doesn't actually do anything scientific, but it can be quite amusing. Now, over at How Stuff Works, we have articles that cover all sorts of stuff, and we even have one on superconductors. And there was one particular section of that article I wanted to quote.
So a little sidebar that was that was just very effective.
Right. This comes straight from our article on superconductors. Superconductors boast more than zero resistance. They also offer extremely high current carrying density, exceptionally low resistance at high frequencies, very low signal dispersion, and high magnetic field sensitivity. They exclude externally applied magnetic fields, exhibit unusual quantum behaviors, and are capable of near light speed signal transmission. This combination of factors effectively rewrites the rules for electromagnetic industries and suggests numerous possible innovations, including improved electric power transmission, generation, and storage, smaller, more powerful magnets for motors, cutting-edge medical equipment, improved microwave components for communications and military applications, vastly boosted sensors, and using magnetic fields to contain charged particles. So that's you know, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the applications, but the potential is phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and thank you to Nicholas Gerbis, or Gerbis, depending on how you pronounce that, for writing that excellent little bit for that article on superconductivity for us.
Yes, yes. It's a great read. I do recommend it. And there are lots of different substances that can exhibit superconductivity. Some of them were, you know, the pure substances we talked about, the metallic elements can do this if you cool them to the correct temperature. Some of them that are not metals can exhibit superconductivity,
like uranium,
or selenium or silicon. Mm-hmm. If you lower the temperature enough, you have to
increase the pressure.
Right. Yeah, that's they don't. If it's at just a normal one atmosphere pressure, you can't get it cold enough to do that. But if you increase the pressures, then that the combination of the pressure and the temperature will have them exhibit this superconductive property. And then you have hot superconductors.
Oh, right. This is that more recent research that was begun in the 80s. And so tell us what hot superconductors do.
Okay. So, you know, we've talked about the idea of cold fusion, the idea of having a fusion reactor that could operate at temperatures that are much lower than what we would expect a fusion reactor to perform at, mm-hmm. right? A hot superconductor is kind of the opposite idea. And while we don't know if cold fusion will ever really work, we do know that hot superconductors are a thing.
Right, right. Well,
but when we say hot, we're talking relative terms. It's still very, very, very cold. It's still cold enough to kill you if you were to be exposed to it. But it's not so cold as to require liquid helium to cool it. So this was something that lots of different people were working on throughout the years, and, you know, just sort of experimenting with different combinations of materials. Again, getting back to that scientist in the lab saying, huh, I wonder what would happen if we did this to this.
That first one was in 1986, I believe. It was discovered by IBM researchers.
That's
and,
right.
They presented a superconductor of barium,
lanthanum.
Lanthanum and copper oxide.
Mm-hmm.
And it could achieve zero resistance at 35 Kelvin.
Right, which is what? Minus
238 Celsius and minus 397 Fahrenheit.
Wow. Lauren does some wicked math in her head. Yeah, and so instead of using liquid helium, that meant that you could use liquid nitrogen.
Which is much more plentiful and inexpensive.
Right, yes. You can, you know, compared to liquid helium, liquid nitrogen, we're lousy with it, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. You can pick it up at the supermarket if you really need to.
The point being that it is much, it really lowered the bar for what you could make a superconductor out of, which meant that suddenly you could use them for a lot more applications. You know, before, only the most well-funded applications could ever afford any sort of superconductor material, because everything we had needed to be cooled down so far that you had to have liquid helium to do it.
Right.
And there are plenty of places out there that are using that kind of material, like the Large Hadron Collider, for example, uses superconductors in its electronics in order for it to increase the speed of proton beams so that they can collide at massive, massive speeds and create a situation that looks like a tiny microcosmic version of the Big Bang,
mm-hmm.
or shortly, immediately following the Big Bang, I guess I should say.
The world record for the hottest, quote-unquote, superconductor was set in 1994, and that was at 138 Kelvin, which is only a mere negative 135 Celsius and negative 211 Fahrenheit.
Right. So, again, still really cold to us. But
downright balmy compared to most other superconductors.
Yeah, it's like a vacation in the tropics, really. And they were using thallium-doped mercuric cuprate, which was comprised of the following elements. So this is what you have on your shopping list if you want to make one of these. It's not easy, and most of these things are poisonous. Mercury, which is poisonous. Thallium, which is also poisonous. Barium, calcium, copper, and oxygen. It's not something that you can actually go and put together on your own.
I wouldn't recommend trying, necessarily.
No. Your average science lab is not going to be able to produce that kind of superconductor. But then we can talk a little bit about what we would use this stuff for, or what's being used already, how it's being already used.
MRI, I think, is the probably most common thing.
Right.
That's magnetic resonance imaging.
Yes, so MRIs are used to look at soft tissues, right? Because X-rays are very good at looking at things like your skeleton, mm-hmm. but they don't pick up soft tissue very well. MRIs, however, are very good at looking at soft tissue. So they became very important in the field of medicine, and superconductors are a great component for MRI machines.
Mm-hmm. As Jonathan mentioned a moment ago, super colliders, such as the Large Hadron Collider.
Yep. And there, of course, there are more than just that. That's just probably the most famous one that people mm-hmm. have heard about recently. Magnetic levitation trains, maglev trains. There's a couple of examples of these, mostly out in Japan, where the idea is to use the superconductors along a track. So you supercool them and you create this quantum lock phenomena, and then there are magnets on the actual train that can allow it to levitate above the track, thus allowing it to move without that friction that would normally cause the train to be less efficient, and allow it to move at a high speed
with a relative minimum of energy input.
Right. Right. And of course, you could also make a train the other way around, where the superconductors are on the train and the magnets are in the track. In fact, I think Japan might have examples of both. I wrote an article years and years ago for Discovery News about it, but frankly, I honestly can't remember at this point. But other things we could use it for, nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy.
That's just very useful in pharmaceutical research.
It catches long.
It does.
Yeah.
Biotechnologies, et cetera, et cetera.
Yep.
They're looking forward to maybe trying to use this in more efficient forms of energy storage or energy capture, like wind turbines.
Right. Also, just other electric generators in general, so that you don't lose as much of that electricity that you've generated through heat. So again, that's one of those things. You know, if we can make power systems more efficient, where more of the electricity we're generating gets to wherever it needs to be to do work, then that's a win for everybody. It means that you have to consume fewer resources because you don't have to worry about losing, you know, X amount of the energy you're trying to produce as heat.
Oh, right. Also, on the quantum level, this could be very useful for things like quantum computers, because it's working on that tiny
quantum scale.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, quantum computers, there's always a supercooling element with quantum computers as well in order to make them work. We've talked about quantum computers in previous episodes, but I have a feeling we're going to need to do a full episode on quantum computers to really explain what the concept is and how they work. Because, again, it gets pretty, I guess Einstein would call it spooky.
I guess he would.
Yeah.
Quantum entanglement, superconductors are used to create quantum entanglement.
Ah, so which is, again, a very important component in things like quantum cryptography.
Right.
Now, you have a note here that I've read, I see in front of me.
I wanted to mention that this is not anti-gravity.
Right.
You are canceling out a magnetic field.
Right.
But
it's not like you have created some way of
some bubble.
Like you can't turn a switch on in a room
gravitons.
And suddenly everyone floats off the floor.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And we're not counteracting gravitons. We still don't really know how gravity actually works.
Right,
I mean, we obviously see the effect of it.
Right, but we don't see the actual mechanism. Mm-hmm,
yeah, back in 1992, there was a Russian physicist whose name I'm not even going to attempt right now. But he claimed to have successfully tested this device that would shield an object from gravity. It involved levitating a superconducting disc above a magnet. And no one in the past couple decades has figured out how, has been able to replicate this experiment. So that's not what we're talking about.
Right, right. And then, of course, the other note I was going to mention was the one about people thought that we somehow reverse engineered superconductors from alien spacecraft.
Yeah, because you know what, Area 51, they were holding all those that alien spacecraft.
That's so weird.
They were you wrote that in
I wrote that whole article, Area 51, and I don't remember any alien spacecraft being in there. No, this is again one of those conspiracy theories where people thought that perhaps humans are not ingenious or inventive enough to have come up with this on our own. Now, granted, since we already talked about how the first experiments with superconductivity date back to 1911, I think we can be safe to say that it's not the Area 51 reverse engineering nonsense.
Well, sure, and, sure. However, I mean, you know, I do see the connection since we started really pushing the technology off the ground in the 1950s and 1947 being the year that
The Roswell incident.
Of the Roswell incident and
also,
all of that.
Keep in mind that Roswell and Area 51 are not remotely close
to each
other.
They're clearly connected.
So I this is where Jonathan says, ladies and gentlemen, humans are amazingly smart and amazingly creative.
And we come up with some amazing accidents.
Yeah. Sometimes we find out, we find stuff that we weren't even looking for, but it becomes really important. And I personally, whenever I think of these reverse engineering stories, it really to me is just downplaying how brilliant people can be. And that kind of gets me a little upset because I've met folks who are truly geniuses at specific fields. And you know, I think it's an insult to them to say that, oh, obviously no person could have thought this up. It's too magical. It must have come from somewhere else.
Also, reverse engineering isn't really easier necessary. I mean,
yeah, because you have to figure out how it works in the first place, and then
it's not like an Independence Day, guys.
Yeah.
You don't just.
No, it doesn't involve using a Mac computer to upload a virus to a mothership. Boy, we could do a full episode on just that would be fun to do sometime. Do a tech stuff episode where we just pick a science fiction film and pick apart all the technical inaccuracies in that film, and we could do that occasionally, just once in a while.
Let us know how you guys feel about that, because that could either be incredibly tiresome or really fun, and
yeah.
I'm not entirely sure which one.
If you guys do think that would be a fun idea, let us know, and I go ahead and propose that Independence Day could be the first film that we tackle.
And that does it for that classic episode on superconductors. Hope you guys enjoyed it. If you have any suggestions for future episodes of Tech Stuff, let me know on Twitter or Facebook. The handle for both is Tech Stuff HSW. And I'll talk to you again really soon. Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
It's brand new, season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Vedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my new podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, chronicles my 6 decades in professional basketball, from growing up in the sport to becoming one of sports TV's first female broadcasters. Join me as I dig deep into the game's history, unearth some wild stories, and talk to my friends from the world of basketball, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley. It's been a wild ride, and now I get to take you with me. Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storm on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.